the Chateau Neuf de Pape. It'll be wasted on Tom. Here, this one. Do you fancy a drop, seeing as you've opened it?
A small one.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hello, I'm Amy.
And I'm Gay.
And together we are the co-founders and joint artistic directors of Human Story Theatre. We focus on new plays with a health and social care issue at heart and aim to be accessible to all.
In 2018, our play Dry was commissioned by the NHS and explores middle-aged, middle-class drinking and how many people don't see their alcohol intake as a problem until it is too late.
I think really deep down, I probably knew that I shouldn't be drinking every day.
I kind of thought that once we were married, he'd be so happy that he wouldn't need to drink anymore.
I know that you can come out the other side.
For every alcoholic, they badly affect at least five other people around them.
Nothing worth having is straightforward, and we wouldn't value it if it was just given to us on a plate.
Welcome to Human Story Theatre, the podcast. Today, I'm joined by a speaker, trainer, and adult child of an alcoholic. She's passionate about helping daughters of alcoholics, helping them overcome the many challenges they now face in their adult life so that they can find some peace. She also trains professionals around how to best help children of alcoholics, as well as volunteering for the charity NARCOA, National Association for Children of Alcoholics, which we can hear more about in a bit. Her mission is to change the judgments and perceptions around alcohol misuse, how we support and treat the problem drinkers and their families in society. Jo Huey, it's my pleasure to chat to you today.
Hello, hiya.
Hello. So, tell me, she says, why are you passionate about helping daughters of alcoholics in particular?
I think for me, I started off focusing on families, and then I realised that actually, you know, when I was talking to people, most of the people I was speaking to were in actual fact daughters, and I could really relate to them. And whilst I recognise that a lot of the characteristics and behaviours are very similar across the family members, I could really relate better to the daughters because I am a daughter of an alcoholic myself. So whenever I spoke to them, I could totally relate to where they were coming from. And so that's really why I decided to focus more on daughters, because that was really my own experience.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, that makes total and utter sense to me.
Yeah.
Would you like to tell me a bit more about your experience of being a daughter of an alcoholic?
Yeah, so really I think I always sort of remember early in my life, I don't know, I was probably 4 or 5 or something like that. And, you know, my dad, I just remember him being a very strict person. He used to be in the army, so he was kind of typical, sort of very regimented in his sort of behaviour and what he expected of us as his daughters. And he was a very kind person, and he was somebody that would do anything for anyone. He was very practical, very hands-on type of person. But what happened over the years as I grew up, he was somebody that was very disconnected from our family, you know, from my older sister and my mum and myself. He would very much sort of segregate himself off, and it was as if he had his own little life, and he'd, you know, stay in his bedroom and he'd watch the telly, he'd make his own dinner and he'd take that in on a little tray, and, you know, he would literally just be by himself when we would all be sat round a dinner table having dinner together.
And would he be drinking during that time alone?
Yeah, I have to say, I'm not a child that actually saw him drinking like that much, because he was very, you know, I'm guessing he was very shameful of his drinking and he hid it a lot. So
right.
Whilst we would find the bottles dotted around the place. I don't recall and remember seeing him actively drinking a lot. I just knew he was because of how he behaved. So it wasn't like I'd see him sit in a chair, knocking back all the lagers, and he'd mostly drink vodka. But most of the time, it was all done in the privacy of his bedroom, or he'd very often sit in the car in our driveway and sit and listen to, you know, Elton John or whoever it was he was listening to. And it was a space that I guess he created for himself that felt safe. He, you know, would just sit in there. And I remember my mum sort of saying, oh, why do you keep sitting in there? It's making you upset listening into it, because he'd really listen to all these sad songs. And so, you know, I think as an adult, I've kind of reflected on what happened and thought, actually, how much of his behaviour was him as a drinker, and how much of him was actually that's his nature and characteristics, and that's the sort of person he was, whether he was drinking or not. So it's been interesting to sort of reflect on that and sort of try to recognise, well, was that just him as a person and it wasn't actually anything to do with the drink?
And how was his behaviour of isolating himself? I mean, how did that affect you and your sister?
Just that he was so absent, and that it, you know, it's very hard to build a relationship with someone that's not there. And
of course, I think that,
you know, if, I don't know, if you've got, say, stepbrothers or something, or stepsisters, and you don't live in the same house or something, you're not going to be as close as the one that you see every day and that you mix with and you spend time with. And so it was a bit like that, really. So obviously he was at work and we were at school. We come home, he wouldn't be home till later. And then obviously he would just, you know, go into the bedroom, or he'd sit in the car and we wouldn't really see him. So it kind of created this sort of void, I guess, and this gap between us, and there was this just total lack of relationship. You know, you couldn't build a relationship from someone that was, well, physically absent, but also, you know, emotionally absent. He wasn't able to share or be open or to, you know, be supportive or to do all of the things that I guess we expect in a healthy, you know, family environment.
I often think that people who are emotionally absent, I actually think that that sometimes is more harm than if they're physically absent.
Yeah, definitely.
It's quite,
because you can't get your head around it, because you just, especially as a child, it's very difficult, very different processing something as a child or as an or if you're processing it as an adult. But I think that for me, you know, when you sort of see somebody there, you want to engage with them. And then if they're not engaging with you, or they're becoming abusive or aggressive or whatever, you just think, I wish you weren't here. But then deep down as a child, they're still the only dad you've got, and you still want that relationship. And there's this conflict, internal conflict that you feel, because it's like, you do want them, but you don't want them in your life, sort of thing, because you don't want the chaos they're causing and the uncomfortable feelings and the, you know, the awkwardness and the embarrassment that you feel and all that uncertainty. You don't want all of that, but you do want the dad that you think he could be. Or sometimes you've seen glimpses of that person, but actually it's only glimpses. But those glimpses sometimes are enough to put your claws into and hold on to, you know, in the hope. Unfortunately, that's an unrealistic hope. I think hope is good in one way, but sometimes I think we attach ourselves to hope that can be a bit unrealistic, and it's just never going to happen.
And also very complex as a child to understand. I mean, how can you possibly understand, and not potentially knowing where you stand with your father too. And obviously children vie for their parents' attention, like you said, and you want to interact with your mum and your dad, because they're the mum and the dad that you have. And if they're, you mentioned about being aggressive. Did you mean in general, or was your dad aggressive sometimes?
Yeah, he was... He would, you know, he'd hit us around the head, the back of the legs. I remember us saying to my mum, or even to him maybe, you know, if you're going to hit us, can you make sure you don't hit us around the head, because it really hurts. And so we were like picking the place, you know. It sounds really, really weird to talk about that and to say that, but it was like we'd just it would be better if you hit us not around our head. And he would shout. And I think it's not just, do you know what? Sometimes it's not just that. It's the what the thoughts and the fear that we can attach to those things that are happening. And I think for me, like he, you know, you're forever thinking, what is he going to do? And this anticipation and all of that sort of mental torture that you put yourself through, even if he was just literally shouting and raising his voice, that's, if you look at it, that's just shouting and raising your voice. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. But as a child in that situation, there's lots of fear. And then you're thinking, what have I done wrong? And you're attaching all sorts of meaning to it. And then what happens is you end up carrying that into your adult life. And so those fears, and when people get angry, then you avoid confrontation because this reminds you of the situation you were with your parent. And so then you don't want to have those confrontational situations because it takes you right back to that time.
Did it affect your sister in a similar way?
Do you know what? It's funny because I guess the more we've done our own podcast and done training with social workers and things and been sharing our story, we've actually sort of heard each other speak about each of our experiences. And I think each of us didn't really appreciate quite how it affected the other and until we'd actually shared it in a public forum. And so, you know,
that's interesting,
isn't it? And I was, you know, she sort of said how much she protected me and everything, which I guess I didn't really, she probably did, but I didn't really think about that. I wasn't sort of on my mind or consciously aware of it as such. But I saw situations quite differently to her. So I felt very overly responsible in the home because we had to help my mum and stuff because my dad wasn't there. But Paula didn't see it like that. And so we've definitely been affected in different ways. And subsequently to that, it's affected our adult life in very different ways. And we're very right. different in how we respond to things. Although there are similarities, and it's interesting because I did a little table recently and outlined like me and my two sisters, because I've got a younger sister as well. And I love categorizing things anyway. So I categorize and I was like, what are the differences between us all? And so yeah. I put us into these, like did these three little columns. And it was interesting because like my characteristics are driven much more by control. They're very, very controlling. Paula's are much more kind of laid back, go with the flow, that type of. And then my younger sister is a blend of both of us.
Right.
And it's really, I just find all that sort of thing fascinating. And when I looked at it, and then subsequently I've been talking to other daughters of alcoholics and just asking them which one would they relate to or is there another one to add? And they usually say, yeah, I'm definitely a one or a two or three, yeah. you know. I found that quite interesting.
I can imagine, for me, it seems obvious that you might want to be in control as an adult and tend towards being controlling, yeah. For better or worse, because as a child in that family situation, you had no control.
Exactly.
And so as you grow up, you're trying to grasp and grab onto any control that you can have, and you can be in control of yourself, not others, of course. But I'm interested about how your other sister is, Paula, is laid back. I mean, that to me, I'm not quite sure how that works. Anyway,
it was interesting because, you know, I think all three of us be people pleasers, but to different degrees. And it depends on the context, as everything is always based around context. So really depends on the situation. And, you know, but we've all got elements of that, definitely, and elements of anxiety. But I'm probably more anxious in certain situations than my sister. And so, you know, but I'm definitely the rule abider. She's the rule breaker. You know, so we've got that very different sort of characteristics and like how she perceived things. Like if Dad told us to do something, I would do it. She'd be like, I'm not doing that, you know, and be the one to stand up to him or to, you know, just do something else. So I found that quite interesting. So yeah, definitely affected us differently. And then how, like I say, how it's affected us in our now life as adults.
Yeah, tell me a bit more about that, about you as an adult now.
I think one of the characteristics that I noticed between us was that I'm very much one for reaching out and asking for help, and my sister isn't. And so she would basically keep her problems to herself or bury them or whatever. And I would, let's say, seek therapy. She would turn to the bottle or food or something. And so those are the different, neither one is right. Both have got ups and downs to them, some worse than others. Ultimately, that is each of the coping strategies that we've both chosen. So I would have chosen the more I need to fix myself and go to therapy and get help. And she's like, I don't need help. I'm just going to drink because that makes me not feel anything. And so that's how it impacted her, because then she developed her own drink problem. So then she was dealing with her own addiction, and she's now nearly 4 years into her recovery. And so, you know, I think psychologically we've handled it very differently.
That's interesting. And just going back to your dad, do you know the reasons why he drank?
We know some of the triggers, but we don't really know why initially. It could have been that, you know, my mum and dad had a child that they lost young, you know,
right,
when she was in the hospital. And then, like, he ended up losing another son. Well, he was 21. He was killed on the railway. And that was a trigger for him to start drinking more heavily. So there were periods in his life which made him drink more, but we don't know the original reason why.
I mean, working in the army can't be easy. There's a lot of, it's talked about a lot nowadays, isn't it? Post-traumatic stress and things like that. So from listening to the radio and reading articles, there is quite a lot of alcoholism within in the army. Because of some of the traumatic experiences. I mean, that's not an excuse. I'm not making excuses for why people do it, but there is usually a trigger, isn't there?
Yeah. And I don't think, I mean, you mentioned the word excuses, and I think, you know, for me, people do things for a reason. I don't see it as an excuse. I think it rolls into excuse if we keep using it as a get-out clause. But I think if we're trying to understand why somebody started drinking or why someone's developed an addiction, I don't think that's an excuse. I think that's a very valid reason for why someone's started drinking. And they equally have to accept the consequences and the responsibility of their decisions and actions and all of that that comes with it. But obviously, if people keep using it as a reason to not do something, then that's when they're using it as an excuse.
Yeah, sure. I know. I completely agree with you. So you volunteer for the charity Narcoa. Tell us about Narcoa.
So it was a couple of years ago, I think. I can't even now remember how I got into it. I must have seen something online or social or something.
Mm.
And so when I saw Narcoa, I just... So for me, they just offer a service that I think is much needed, and working with people like me, like I would have been like as a child. And I just can't say how amazing they are, all the work that they do and all the people that they help, you know. And without them, those children, those family members wouldn't get the support that they're getting at the moment. And whilst they're hugely underfunded, and, you know, which is always the way with charities and things, you're trying to, you know, run on a budget, aren't you? And
yes.
deficit. But they do a lot of work, and they have actually been instrumental in getting us a Minister for Children of Alcoholics, as well as doing a lot of work and creating Children of Alcoholics Week here in the UK. And so it's just, I find it amazing that there is something out there, a phone line that family members can call, speak to trained counsellors and get some support. And it's all anonymous, which I think is one of the key issues that families will struggle with is they don't want people to know who they are.
Sure, yeah.
And so that service for me, and just generally, you know, the work they do in all sorts of ways, like I say, with government, all the, you know, help and support they provide online through social is just another opportunity for people to feel heard and supported. So I think the work they do is fantastic.
And that's the National Association for Children of Alcoholics, yep. NACOA, isn't yeah. it? And I've seen you, Jo, on Sky News, BBC News, ITV. Tell us about that.
Well, some of that work actually came through NACOA because I volunteer for them in a capacity where I do some of the press interviews when things like, mainly when Children of Alcoholics Week comes up, but anything really big stories, when they released some money not long ago, they generally are looking for people to interview. So, yeah, so I had the opportunity to go on to be, well, I've done Sky News, BBC and ITV. And so it was an amazing opportunity. I mean, crikey, you don't often get the chance to talk about this sort of stuff on national TV, and to be able to go on there and start raising awareness about this topic that seems still to this day on the back burner. It is, I get it. It's not a very sexy topic to talk about. And, you know, there's all the shame and guilt and everything that comes along with it. But we have done it with mental health. As far as I'm concerned, we are streets ahead. We're not, you know, by any means there, but we're streets ahead with mental health in terms of where it was a few years ago. We're talking about it. You know, the royals are involved. All this stuff is happening. People are starting to feel comfortable enough to talk about their mental health. And I believe that that's where we need to get to with alcohol misuse. But it's
so
nowhere
near
that.
Do you think it's still a taboo?
Yeah. And obviously, you know, that one of the biggest problems that you've got as well is people's judgments and perceptions around it. And I totally understand why that is, because why would people understand about something if they actually have never had firsthand experience of it or been educated about it or had any exposure to it? You know, you are going to be in the dark, just like I would be with physical disabilities, let's say, or, you know, different diversity, because I haven't worked in that space. I don't have that, you know, but I'm not particularly, I haven't got strong opinions about it, but some people do have very strong opinions about alcohol misuse. And so even if they don't know anything about it, they will have a judgment about that person and about the type of person they are and what they should and shouldn't be doing and how they should or shouldn't be behaving. Yet we probably wouldn't do that with a lot of other illnesses and issues. So they already feel bad. They already feel bad about what they're doing, and they're drinking because of probably trauma they've been through. And then we're punishing them again by judging them about their choice of drink or drug or whatever it is they're using. So it's a tough one, I think. And I think it is, it's complex, you know, it's not a straightforward thing. And I do understand why people have the judgments and perceptions they do. But I've been able to learn a lot more since my father died and I've started my business and I've gone into this field. I've been able to have that understanding. And so now I can be more objective and I can really understand where these people are at and why they are where they are. And I will always say to them, you know, I'm not saying that what you've done and the carnage you've caused is okay, but I understand why it's happened.
Yeah, and I think that's massively important, to focus on the reason why people are turning to drink or drugs or whatever, rather than the actual drinking itself. I think if it's not looked at, then the problem will never go away. And also there's this perception that alcoholics are the homeless people on the park bench drinking, you know, I don't know, meth or, and it isn't. It happens behind closed doors of normal families.
It could be anybody. It's not You know, that whole thing about people being on a park bench is so old school.
Old school, but to my surprise, still thought by lots of people. I do think that that stigma or that belief is still out there. Now, Gay wouldn't forgive me if I didn't ask you to end on a Pollyanna moment.
Pollyanna moment.
Pollyanna, the glad game, the hopefulness. In our Q&As, Gay always asks our speakers to share something hopeful or positive that we can all leave with a thought. So a hopeful nugget for those daughters or indeed sons or mothers or fathers of alcoholics.
I think one of the reasons I do what I do and, you know, I help people that have been affected like I have is because I know that you can come out the other side. And, you know, I'm not saying it's an easy road because nothing worth having is straightforward, and we wouldn't value it if it was just given to us on a plate. And I wanted quite a lot of change in my life, but that was based on the fact I'd had many years being told I wasn't good enough in a sense, and I wasn't okay as I was. But I have managed to take that, and my decisions were, I need to go and get some therapy. I need to go and get help. I need to go and deal with these things. And I have, and I've then become like an NLP practitioner. I do emotional freedom technique. I've done Reiki. And that's what's helped me now to work with, you know, individuals and to help them, because I've been through it. I've been through the lived experience, and then I've trained myself as well. And I've had the therapy. So I just want people to know that they don't have to accept what their life is now if they're not happy, and don't think that that's all it can be, because you don't know what it can be until you start looking. And so for me, when I started doing all this work, it then just evolves, because then you start to get that awareness and you think, God, you know, I never thought I could do this, and now I've done it. And so what else can I do next, and what other things do I want to change about my life? Because I think that as children of alcoholics specifically, we don't really know who we are, because we've spent so long focusing on the drinker. And so it's a perfect opportunity for us to start to think, right, well, what is it that's actually important to me in my life? What is it that I want? Not what my parents told me and all the things I've learned over the years, but what do I want? And so it's really important that people know that that life you've had does not have to dictate your present and future. You can actually change that.
And use that experience, as you are doing, to do wonderful things and to help other people. And I think there is nothing more valuable than lived experience. I mean, I'm sad that you've had to have that lived experience, but what you're doing and how you're using that through all the work that you do is really fantastic, Jo. So from me and Gay, you know, keep up that good work. Please.
I will.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you've been affected by anything in this podcast, please visit our website, humanstorytheatre.com/podcast, for information about organisations that can offer support. In the next episode, I'll be chatting to Nikki from Al-Anon.
I was very naive in those days, and I didn't realise the nature of what a terrible addiction alcohol is, how hard it is for people to give up.
And Oliver Sampson from Turning Point.
Somebody walks in with a GP surgery with a broken arm. The GP can x-ray it, know it's a broken arm, define it as a broken arm, and actually give you a pretty definitive time frame, if you do what's suggested, when it will be healed. But if you walk into a GP surgery and say, I think I'm an alcoholic, the GP has nothing to go on.
Do subscribe to Human Story Theatre on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, to make sure you don't miss it.